Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Jack Caesar of Caesar, Inc., the design team behind games based on major pieces of IP like Labyrinth, The Dark Crystal, and My Little Pony, as well as their original game, Doom Song. Jack, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So good to have you.
It's great to have you. We've been looking forward to this for a little bit.
So, Jack, we're really excited to talk to you today. We want to kind of have a broad discussion about your work at Caesar, Inc., specifically narrowing in on kind of what it means to make licensed IP into RPGs, and then how that sort of translates into then making original projects, getting into the business, the creative, some other concerns. First, though, I want to do a fun question. The fun question being, do you have a dream IP that you would love to make into an RPG that you haven't had a chance yet?
So, yes and no. I think discounting the sort of pretentious answer of working on your own stuff is always wonderful and the best thing ever. I remember pushing really hard and really trying to like get the company I was working for at the time to pick up the Mortal Engines IP.
Oh, sure.
And this was basically in the run-up to the movie coming out. So I was full on like this. It's going to be huge. It's going to be great. It's going to, you know, if we pick it up before it's popular, then the movie will come out and it's got Peter Jackson behind it. How could it possibly be bad? And then it was a complete damp squib. So, but that world, I think, is so like set up for adventure and fun vibes. And then it's got this whole thing of like, and I read it as a young adult, but like, the sort of real worldy grittiness to it, but also that like kids adventure also thrown in. I think like young adult stuff really gets a pass. Like you can go for much darker stuff when you're writing for like for kids than you'd ever get away with in television and stuff. But I think it's an awesome world. That would probably be my go.
That is such a cool world. It is such a shame that movie flopped so bad.
And it's done the whole thing. It's like tainted my love of the world in a way that...
Mm.
Like,
oh, no!
You kind of want yourself to be above and want yourself to say, no, you know, I can just love the books. I can sort of remember that. And like, no, it's this. It is this little like, oh, wish it was better.
Yeah, the Game of Thrones effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Wild.
Anyway, before we get too upset about IPs that have hurt our feelings.
So Mortal Engines, I think, is a great piece of IP to be adapted into a tabletop role-playing game. And I'm curious, from your perspective as someone who works in a lot of licensed IP, what to you is one of the best indicators that a certain piece of IP will work as a tabletop role-playing game? Like, what are the signpost that you're looking for of something like, oh, this is going to work and this will be successful both as a game and as a product?
So I think that a lot of that is in intuition and adventure stories, things that have sort of action and stuff happening, especially if it's in a sort of world that is kind of set up for group dynamics, which a lot of like fiction isn't. A lot of fiction has a main character and maybe a supporting cast, which is less so about the world, because role plays are obviously set up in a different way to most other media. But that kind of support for multiple different cool people doing different things in that world and having adventures, which is about the most generic way I could have put that, is, I think, a really, really good indicator. Sometimes you'll have something that's like, that inspires a completely different mode of play, like something that is sort of very social based, like, you know, doing a Pride and Prejudice sort of thing, and which I've completely, I know what game I'm thinking of, but I've completely lost the title of it.
Good Society.
Good Society, yes. And if you're like taking a completely different view, that is like exciting in its own right. But I think generally what you're looking for, I think especially if you're looking at a product that translates as an obvious thing at the table, adventure stories, things that have these sort of differing ways of interacting with the world. So if it has a magic system or a high sci-fi vibe, then that's like easier to adapt than Band of Brothers. I think that was actually something that was super like interesting when I was doing work on the Discworld role-playing game with Modiphius. we were having a lot of talks and a lot of back and forth about how that product should sort of play out. One of my suggestions was actually to essentially do it like Sherlock Holmes consulting detective, almost doing it as a series of like watch mysteries, because in that world, you don't really have the kick down the door violence. Like, the only adventurers that exist in Discworld are like in the first couple of books and their parodies of 80s fiction. And so you really don't have that, like, that classic loop, something that games like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons have down solid, at least old school Dungeons and Dragons, of like, you know what the game is about as soon as you like open the book. Whereas I think some media finds that more difficult to find its feet if it's sort of more ideas based than narrative or plot based, which I think is a really difficult type of game to like present as a mode of play. But for Discworld, it is not only like the way that fits in a lot of ways the best, but when you have the other options, like you don't have adventure and you don't have going to far-flung lands, because 90% of the series is based in one city, so you don't have all this like excuses you can use in a lot of other games to just like fling adventure out. The mystery is definitely a big thing that's left.
And sort of looking at the inverse of Brian's question, what does a successful, by your measure, IP-based game look like? So we talked a bit about like what IP works well for games, but how do you know when a game based on an IP is working well for that IP, is a successful sort of licensed adaptation?
I think a really good sign is when it drills down on what it wants to be. So an analogy, I guess, would be not an RPG, but something like Netrunner, where you've got the mechanics are so tied into the theme of what you're doing, and you can only play one thing, and you're only really exploring one mode of play, but that is supported to the hilt. And so I think what a lot of IP games sort of stumble at is this idea of, well, we're doing Star Wars, therefore you have to be able to be a Jedi, and you have to be able to be this and that and that and that. And like, especially with something, I've obviously chosen the most mammoth like IP in the world that has, you know, a ridiculous amount of content written by, you know, a thousand authors. But like, you can't get that all into one. And the game probably would be a bit muddled if you were trying to get all of that into one place. So I think the really successful stuff is like Edge of the Empire was the Star Wars one that focused on, you're like a small group of smugglers doing smuggler stuff. And like, you know, Blades in the Dark is not an IP, but that sort of, you are doing one thing and we are supporting how you're doing that one thing. Whereas I think with IPs, it can be quite tempting to just give a conflict resolution mechanic and say, here's a load of information about the world, here you go. And we've called the stats the things that are in the game, which it kind of does the trick a lot of the time, but I don't think it's a good sign.
It is a thing that I feel like before we started having conversations on this show about licensed games, like using intellectual property to make tabletop role-playing games, I'd always seen like the Cowboy Bebop role-playing game and just felt like, that feels... For some reason, I had a negative reaction to it. I was just like, it's going to be a random dice system on just top of Cowboy Bebop. But the more I get into conversations about licensed IP games and like actually dive into them, this is just another instance of me realizing like, oh, I made a judgment call on this way before I had information that I should have. this is an aspect of growth for me, I think.
In prepping for this and in hearing you talk, I'm reminded of a conversation that we had recently with Jess Levine, who designed Going Rogue, one half of Galactic and Going Rogue, which is crowdfunding at time of recording, probably done by the time people are hearing this, but it is a Star Wars-inspired adaptational game. And one of the things Jess talked to us about was when you're tackling adaptational media, you are speaking to, you have to love the thing and you also kind of have to hate it. You have to have things you hate about it. And that, I think, is interesting from like a, I'm a fan of something, I'm adapting the spirit of this. When you're working with like a true IP license adaptation, do you find that like your own love and hate play into how you approach a do you find this sort of axiom to be true?
So I think that being a true like fan in the traditional sense of like an actual fanatic about whatever you've got is a real double-edged sword. I think it's really good for the simple like knowledge. There's an amount of research that is difficult to do if you're not sort of, you've already done it in your own time and you spent hundreds of hours like in that world or whatever. But on the other hand, I think it makes it really hard to like translate that love into like game mechanics and in for other people. Something that we'll find really often when we are doing an RPG for an IP or something is that, you know, we won't be the first people to do that because we have a beautifully homebrewy like hobby where there'll be somebody who's almost certainly converted like Dungeons and Dragons into whatever world it is. But there'll be people like creating their own stuff. And these people will be like huge fans of the thing. And not to like, it's often like there's cool stuff and it's good stuff, but often it is for the fans in a very like, for the people who know all the like proper nouns and all of the everything about that world, like before they even step in. Whereas often like for a product, you are trying to create something that like sinks you into that world. And yeah, that sort of, I think you need to be both. You need to know, obviously you need to immerse yourself in the world. You need to understand why it is loved and you need to love it yourself. You need to tell you like, I've definitely worked on games and worlds that like I've enjoyed and I've understood, but unless I was working on them, I wouldn't have made them like my world. I wouldn't have dived into them. So I've worked on the Hunger Games board game. I love the Hunger Games. I think it's a really cool like book series. The film series is fine. And sort of working on that, we did a load of research basically into what is loved about it. What do people like get out of this? And there's a thousand stories based around that whole process. But skipping all of that aside for now, I think that being disinterested, not uninterested, but disinterested, being able to be like an impartial observer and be able to go, oh, this isn't working, and not be blinded by love is a super important thing. So I think you kind of need both. And often as well, you can work with fans and you can get that knowledge in the same way that you can work with, you know, a designer and get the sort of institutional like game design knowledge as well. Like you can bring in these skills and sort of as part of a team create something that evokes the IP, while sometimes it's not sort of what the first person would have gone, oh, I want to make the Hunger Games board game. That's my joy. That's my passion. But at the end of the day, like that still exists, that you still have to like dissect it either way. And actually it's kind of easier to dissect if you don't already love it, because you don't look at things with like, you don't break them apart and go, why do I love Avatar The Last Airbender? Mm-hmm. I mean, I do know why. I have actually watched a lot of videos on why it's amazing. But to do that in a like, in a work sense does take a little bit of the magic, like of like, okay, now we're going to break this apart and try and work out like, not only why do I love it, but why is it loved in general?
I hadn't thought of it so succinctly that like the key to making a great game based on an established IP is not focusing on the plot or the characters that made that IP successful, but rather like the feeling of being in the world. Like, I don't think there's a lot of people who would want to play Spike Spiegel in a Cowboy Bebop game, but a lot of people would want to live in a Cowboy Bebop world. As you're doing, I'm very curious about the research and like the kind of getting up to speed on a property that you wouldn't otherwise have interest in. as you're doing that research process, what do you find to be the most like influential pieces of information or pieces of the world that you, that are the things that are like become your linchpins for the game? Like the idea of why people love a thing is kind of hard to quantify. How do you go about finding that and weaving it into a game?
Step one is just like, is like any property, is watching the thing and experiencing it kind of as, like, usually I'm aware of whatever I'm working on, and actually usually I am a fan of it and I am into it. I think a good example of like something that I that like wasn't made for me and I wasn't a fan of is the My Little Pony universe. I basically was aware of it around, this was maybe 8-9 years ago, and when we started work on that, I went out and I watched every episode, and I did have to take like breaks every now and then to sure. go play on something like really gory or something, you know, something yeah. really like to like bring me back down on the sparkles and the friendship.
I like the idea that you got too high on My Little Pony. You're like, yeah. no, I need some grim dark to level me out.
Yeah, I need to like watch an episode of My Little Pony and then Always Sunny in Philadelphia or something to really level it out.
There'll be times when me and my wife are like watching a like dark crime drama and we'll be like ready to go to bed and we'll be like, hey, do we need to watch like one episode of Bob's Burgers before we go to bed? Like, we can't go to bed on this note.
Well, with that, like, there are, that's a slightly different one because there are two really distinct fan bases for My Little Pony. There is the sort of outspoken one, the bronies, the adult fans of My Little Pony. But that's actually quite a small part, or at least it was, a small part of that fan base. The larger one is the one that you'd kind of assume if you hadn't heard of anything, and that's, you know, young girls and the parents of young girls and young boys, but overwhelmingly young girls. Hasbro did like a whole trying to bring it in and make it more gender diverse, because, you know, young boys have money to spend as well. But it was definitely like overwhelmingly that. And so that was more about the parents and trying to, because we ended up aiming that product at, hey, dad, mom and dad play Dungeons and Dragons. They play, you know, the role-playing games, and they want to share that hobby with their kids. So they're going to see this and they're going to say, oh, this is actually a world in which my kid knows more about the world than I do and can sort of jump into that world. And so suddenly that's sort of piecing together where this product sits and how it goes from a shelf, how it's played, and how it's sort of why it's bought, and that sort of line. Because there is the laziest thing you can do is to set, you know, slap a rule system on it, fill it full of information about the world, and say laziest is maybe a strong word there, but you just make a sort of informational packet for the fans and say, here you go, you love this world, you'll buy it because you love it. And the Holy Grail, of course, is something that's like lasting and great because of its own sort of merits and sort of transcends the game that it's sort of a part of. And so, yeah, trying to like find out why the fans love it. So in that case, it was, we basically aimed at the parents and the kids, and why they love it is all the wholesome reasons and all the adventures, and making your own pony was a huge part of it, like OCs and that sort of thing. So focusing on that, and sort of you build this picture of your perfect customer, the fan of My Little Pony, and build out from there. And so I think it's a bit holistic. It's a bit like gut feeling in a lot of ways. And I think whilst I wasn't a big brony, I did learn a lot about My Little Pony. I did respect it. And that's the main thing. Like, even if it's not like precisely for you, if you don't respect it and think that it is a good example of what it is and how to like take that and change it to a different medium, then you're not going to get anywhere.
Kind of drilling down one more level from that, like when it, like you said, like, yeah, often there's an impulse where people just like slap 5e onto a project. We've been burned by projects in the past for that. And I'm curious, like when you're getting into the mechanical heft of a game, that like that real capital G, capital D game design of mechanics, what are you thinking about in terms of applying mechanics to these IPs? Are you abstracting certain moments? Are you like, you know, are you abstracting more of just a broader feel? How do you kind of approach the mechanical design elements?
So once you've got your ideal customer or your the person that you think is going to be picking this up and playing it, which can be different based on the IP that you're working with. So like, I think nerdier IPs or traditionally nerdier IPs that slot in more with role-playing games, you can sort of start at a place and you're expected to start at a place that is more sort of crunch heavy. So like the One Ring. If you've heard of Lord of the Rings and you're into Lord of the Rings, like it's pretty likely you also know about role-playing games and are probably also into role-playing games. And so I think your starting point there is at a point where you're not like introducing really core stuff. Whereas something like the Labyrinth and Dark Crystal that we worked on, we were coming at it as much more of a like, the place that people are probably starting on is as a fan of Labyrinth and Dark Crystal rather than an RPG player looking for a new game. So those with the Labyrinth especially, we went super simple. Like that system is you roll it, the GM decides a difficulty from 2 to 6. You roll a D6. If you hit the number, you did it. Great. And if you have a skill that helps you out, you're rolling 2 dice and take highest. And if you have a flaw that's like not going to help you, roll 2d6, take lowest. And that's essentially the core of the system. And then we use a very like loosey-goosey, just descriptive, like, oh, you're a fiery, you can take your arm off. Like, you work out what that means. We're not going to tell you. We're not going to say, and it must stay 30 feet away from you. And if you do this, then it will wither away. And after d6 days, then blah, 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 blah. And we filled that one. So the Labyrinth is filled with almost like party games, because that's like a linchpin that like there's a bit where you open the book and you're expected to like throw darts onto the book as part of the game, and sort of these like novelty and exciting like weird and wonderful dinner party things that you could like present to your friends who maybe have no idea what a role-playing game is. Whereas if you're doing like Lord of the Rings or even the My Little Pony game that we were working on, was coming at it from the idea of, this is mum and dad, they probably do know what role-playing games are, and they're presenting it to their kids. So it kind of does need to hit all the bases. It needs to have everything, because kids are very sensitive to seeing stuff pulled out. Like, they're aware that, wait a second, I'm not playing with all the dice. Like, I should be playing with the polyset, because that's what you guys use. And so, yeah, when it comes to mechanics, it is like that's like kind of how crunch is decided, is like who's playing this and why are they playing this and what are they expecting from it. If it's something like a Lord of the Rings or a combat heavy world, then like combat is always the place that like crunch seeps in. You make a beautiful svelte system that's like, oh, you have like 3 things that you need to keep track of, and then suddenly I need to come up with grapple rules today. Or like I have to come up with what happens when someone pulls a gun on someone else, and suddenly that's important that it matters exactly how that's resolved. It's also really important with combat, like that it's resolved in the way that the world resolves it. So, you know, in My Little Pony, you get knocked out, and it's a really like super simple combat system that's surprisingly brutal. Whereas that was actually a design decision we made to be like, if combat happens, we don't want to say no, it can't. But if combat happens, we want it to be over as literally as quickly as possible. So it's like 2 dice rolls and someone's knocked out, like, or has run away, or you've decided that friendship is a better course or something. But yeah, I mean, it's good advice for anything that isn't like trying to be a tactical crunchy RPG, right? It's like, if it's not the focus of your game, like getting it done in like 2-3 rounds is honestly always always a good thing to aim for, even if you miss.
The nugget in there that's going to stick with me for the longest is kids don't want to feel like they're playing the kid version. Like, kids don't want stuff to be taken out because they know they want to play the real thing. But you, if you design it so it looks like the real thing, that's really speaking to the audience.
That's huge. I learned a lot doing My Little Pony game, especially running it, because we ran it at cons, just, you know, we ran it at UK Games Expo, we ran it at PonyCon, which is the My Little Pony convention, which was wild. But because it's a fascinating, like, it's those two fan bases, like the bronies and the parents with kids, all sort of like mixing. And so running for kids, like, is a really interesting thing, especially since they're obviously not my kids. And so you learn a lot about how they interact with it and how, I mean, some of my favorite people to play with are people who are like new to role-playing games and don't have the preconceived notions of how it all works. And kids are that on steroids. Like, their idea of role-playing games is often like just, I say whatever I want to be true, and then I expect that to be true. And actually, when you like pin down and you make dice into it, and like there's this, sometimes this friction and sometimes this spark of like, oh, okay, yeah, there's a die involved. It's a game now rather than just make-believe. But yeah, the whole thing on not missing out and stuff, and also just digesting rules in a way that I think a lot of design for kids is often like infantilizing, which they are kids, but the original D&D was played by 13-year-olds, like, and that thing is dense and impenetrable and like has rules for how many, like, when you crash two ships together, how to decide how many oars are broken, like, and like that was given to a 13-year-old. They were told to just play it and it was unplayable and it was fine. Like, they worked it out. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of attempts to make things as simple as possible for younger audiences, which I think can sometimes actually like make it feel like they're not playing the real version of it.
If 13-year-olds can learn encumbrance rules in D&D 1E, like, they can do anything. They're just as able to do things as anyone else.
13-year-olds are a lot smarter than I think people think, just like when you think about it. Like, when you try to like imagine a 13-year-old, I think people picture a younger kid than they are.
Hey, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about some cool new stuff from our friends at Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your web browser. Hero Forge is constantly releasing new content, and they've just launched their latest feature, custom acrylic keychains. These keychains use the same technology as their color standees and are the perfect way to rep your beloved character when you're out in the world. They are highly detailed, ridiculously durable, and made of 1/8-inch thick acrylic featuring front and back color printing, measured on the same 30mm scale as Hero Forge minis and standees, which means they will be a one-for-one match for your heroes on the battle map. Plus, Hero Forge just released stainless steel minis. These are perfect for anyone who is looking for the retro feel of old-school minis. These stainless steel minis have a textured finish and a rugged, highly durable feel. So visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom keychains and steel minis today. Trenchcoat Raccoons is a fast, fail-forward TTRPG of chaotic heists, cartoon logic, and glorious disaster. Each player is one raccoon in a stack, all pretending to be a very suspicious human in a trench coat. Everyone rolls to help or hinder the main action, and every plan gets hilariously derailed by your raccoon's wild impulses. Steal cursed loot across a world of glam horror, glittering galas, mad science, and cryptid conspiracies. Think the slick heist energy of Sly Cooper, the camaraderie of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the paranormal absurdity of Gravity Falls, all jammed into one stack of disaster raccoons.
Trenchcoat Raccoons is launching on GameFound in mid-October, and followers that back at the physical pledge tier level will get a free glow-in-the-dark Raccoon D6 dice. So go right now to GameFound.com and search for Trenchcoat Raccoons.
Hey campers, have you heard of season 5 of 5 GMs in a Trenchcoat from Inside the Tent? You haven't? Well, let us tell you about it.
A nice, green, natural regional park. This is Hidden Falls Regional Park. For our purposes in our world, it's a bit larger than it actually is. It is the summer of 1983, and it is all of your first time getting to stay at Hidden Falls.
We promise it's going to be a great time. It's going to be a story of three childhood friends going across the Americas in 1987 using Kids on Bikes, second edition. So grab a blanket, make some coffee. The first three episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Kind of moving away from the design elements of working with licensed IP and kind of going into like more of the business side of this element. When you are approached for one of these games, how does marketing change when you are working with licensed IP? Is that something that becomes easier because there's a lot of like preconceived notions around it? Or is it harder in any way because there are a lot of preconceived notions around it?
I mean, there's sort of no getting around the fact that like a gigantic reason to do an IP game from a business perspective is because you're getting that free marketing. Not free marketing, you're paying 10%, whatever it is, to the license holder. But you're getting like a huge amount of assets that are already existing and drawn in that world, especially if it's something that has, you know, a huge art library. And you're also getting just the general institutional knowledge, and all the fans are going to find you. And so you've got this sort of customer base that you're like, you're building off of. So in that sense, like the marketing is easier. You know exactly who you're aiming at, and you have this core audience that are sort of willing to give you a listen, to, you know, sit down at the table and work out what you're actually trying to sell them. And, you know, there's a fair amount of people who will sit down at the table and go, oh, actually, this isn't for me. But you've also got this sort of group of people who wouldn't have picked up a role-playing game, but will look at anything that has David Bowie on the front and go, okay, I'll give this a look. And maybe they're drawn into it and they love it. And it's this like this point at which you become part of the hobby. I think IP games are a huge thing for that. I realize it's getting off of like how marketing's different, but I think that is something that IP games can do almost uniquely compared to a lot of other sort of things, is that it gives people confidence that they know what this is, at least in part. So, you know, I know what Lord of the Rings is. So when I sit down to play the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, I've done half of the work. I know what we're doing. Whereas even something that's only like one step away with Dungeons and Dragons, like every piece of media about playing Dungeons and Dragons is about how weird and wacky the world is. You know, Community's Dungeons and Dragons episodes. Like, I don't know if Pegasus exists in this world. And like, it's that not knowing what's in the world that can make it quite difficult to like, or quite intimidating to approach. And so in that sense, you have this sort of huge tap of people that would never have been interested in, you know, if you rub the serial numbers off and said, you know, this is the adjacent role-playing game that is very much like Star Wars, but doesn't have the word Star Wars on it. You've got all of those people who like are willing to give it a chance. And so you can market sort of directly to them. And there's no like competition between those and sort of the rest of your TTRPG pool. Although honestly, I think like our industry is kind of, it's small enough and there's so many people who are discovering it that I don't think there is competition, obviously, but I don't think it's like as cutthroat as other opportunities, especially when we're talking about like we're a fairly small company. Like we definitely don't think about anything like how do we get ahead of the other guy or anything like that.
And then, like, further on the business side, you mentioned in there that, like, you're paying a fee offense to the license owner. What, like, from a just, like, nuts and bolts business perspective does this relationship look like? Are you approaching licensors? Are they approaching you? And, like, what does that deal look like?
So it happens both ways. Generally, like, so licensors are generally looking to sell, you know, their IP. What they are really, like, skittish isn't the right word, but basically if a company hasn't done something licensed before, there's going to be a lot of trepidation, right? What a licensor really likes to do is, like, look at a thing you've done and say, oh, it'll be like that, but with my license on it. So when we were working with Riverhorse, we were doing a lot of this stuff, like, more directly. Now we do mostly, like, contract design stuff for other studios like Mantic and Modiphius. And so basically it happens to it both ways. There's a big convention called BLE. I think there's a version that's in the US as well. But that's the British Licensing Expo, which is essentially a load of different companies that have licenses coming and saying, hey, do you want to make t-shirts of my thing? Or do you want to make, you know, a One Piece brand beer or something? Like, and some of these are, like, shows and worlds and things that are suitable for RPGs, and some of them are, like, Ferrari. And so you've got this sort of group of just, like, people trading these ideas. And what's really interesting about board games and role-playing games is that they're really unique in a sense. They are a game based around your IP, which is, you know, very different to a t-shirt or a beer brand or whatever. But on the other hand, from a licensor's point of view, they are a huge amount of work for not really much return. So RPGs, you sell less of them than t-shirts. They cost about the same to the consumer, and the amount of effort it takes from the licensor to make that work. Like, with a t-shirt, they look at it and go, yep, that's an approved piece of art. Go ahead, make 10 billion of them, sell them in Hot Topic or whatever. Whereas, like, an RPG is, cool, there's 20,000 words. I guess we have to read that and make sure that it... And also, this is a recurring thing, and every licensor is different. Some of them, like, get it, and some of them really don't. Some of them are like, okay, but we can't break canon. Like, we can't break the world. Hunger Games was a big one for this, of like, we can't change anything. It's like, this is a game. Like, the Capitol can win this game. The Resistance can win this game. I realize that's not what happened in the show, but if it can't be changed, then none of this, like, works. In The Dark Crystal, there was a really good, like, they sort of came up against this problem as well, of like, because we were setting that one basically between the end of the series and the beginning of the film. So it's like this empty blank space where there was a Gelfling resistance and everything went terrible and huge apocalypse. Very cool. And so they basically were very skittish, and I think rightfully so, of like, if we say what happens here, then suddenly when they do decide to do a second season or they do decide to do something there, like, there's this official product that said what's happened there. So basically at the start of that book, there's a poem that's like, I can't remember it verbatim, but it says, you know, the events of the season, those are events that happen in stone. These are events that happen in flame. They are but smoke. They are a story for you to tell. And sort of that disclaimer at the front, done in a very poetic style, being like, don't worry about it. This is just what's happening. Yeah, so from a, like, licensor's point of view, it's a lot more of a risk. And the quantities are generally just, like, not as big as a lot of these licenses are, like, expecting. Or not expecting. They come into it sort of knowing what they're getting into. But from their point of view, it's, like, a lot more effort to make sure that you know, haven't filled a book full of slurs or whatever, but also that the outcome is often, like, the volumes are lower and things like that. So I do get it from that point of view. But yeah, generally, generally, that's, I think, why mostly it's companies going to them and going, we have this cool idea and we'll give you an MG and we'll, you know, we'll pay you royalties.
An MG in that is what?
Oh, so yeah, that's a minimum guarantee. So in general, if you are licensing something, you will work out a royalty rate. Let's say it's 12%. And you will work out an MG. So let's say your MG is 20 grand. You would say, we're going to pay you 20 grand tomorrow. And then we're not going to pay royalties on the first 20 grand worth of stock that we sell. So basically, in the long run, assuming everything goes well, it's just a royalty rate. But the minimum guarantee is an upfront for if you decide to not make the product or if it, you know, completely does nothing.
Like an advance in book publishing kind of same.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that might even be. We just always call it an MG, a minimum guarantee.
And then kind of transitioning into, you know, original work, I'm curious, like being a business that's made a lot of licensed IPs, like how does that change the way you now approach like original content with like Doomsong is your original IP? How does having been known for and made a bunch of IP games kind of change how the business sees making original content?
I think the biggest thing that we're really aware of is that we are, which is kind of unique, we are presenting our world to people for the first time. So if it's the My Little Pony world, like, you've heard of that. Even if you don't know it, you've heard of it. And you have a load of assumptions, and you might, if you're a big fan of it, you'll know a load of the characters and a load of the ideas. And we can drag, when you're doing an IP work, you can sort of pull on that knowledge and use it to cement game mechanics and sort of say, okay, you know, your stats are going to be related to the elements of harmony. And so that's a piece of knowledge you have as a fan that we can harness to make this thing easy to remember. And you don't have that when you're doing your own IP. You're having to, you know, start from level one and go. I mean, often you, like, whenever we're selling at shows or whenever we're, like, talking to people about it, we obviously start with, like, it is like this. It is, you know, it is these two things. It is all of these, like, lynch points that you can sort of bring together to be what the vibe of Doomsong is, which is a, for anyone who doesn't know, it is a medieval horror RPG. We call it a role-playing macabre, set in a world that is currently undergoing a biblical apocalypse. So there is a lot of pulling on sort of known tropes of like an oppressive church, an overbearing sort of ecclesiarchy. We have made a lot of effort to try and basically either make something very uniquely weird or sort of very memorable and as part of a set. So, for example, the traitor gods are the sort of gods of the setting. They are the source of all the magic in the world, and it's heretical, and the church hates that. And all the gods are called things like hope, toil, pestilence, death, and they're all like these nouns that are immediately evoke something. Whereas if it was like Margoth and Lolth and,
right,
you know,
then it's names you have to memorize.
Then, yeah, it's names you have to memorize and you have to like then associate with something. Whereas I have, you know, if a god's called Justice, I probably have some ideas of what that might be. And when I'm role playing and I learn that my character, you know, something is to do with justice, then I'm suddenly thinking of almost puns. I'm thinking of connections to that. And so we basically try and do a lot of work on the world building end to make this stuff as like digestible as possible. So something we did do is in the character creator is like a choose your own adventure book almost that takes you through your character that like spoon feeds you little bits of lore about the world that your character knows. And so we're not saying, hey, learn about, you know, the hierarchies of this world and how farming works and also, you know, what happens to witches when they're found and all this and all the gods and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a huge, huge book full of lore. We're saying that, you know, you're playing a rat catcher. And so you'll know that rats are connected to veracity in some way. And that's one of the gods. And sort of that's the knowledge that you have and you need. And sort of if you choose to play a crofter or something, then you learn a bit about that character. And that's a really conscious choice, whereas in a sort of IP focused thing, you do generally have the knowledge that even if they're not a fan of the IP, the person playing it probably is aware of it. You're hoping they're aware of it. That's why you're probably doing an IP focused game. So yeah, there's a lot of intentionally trying to make things as easy to grok and understand. It's one of the sort of running jokes of, so our writer is, she has a doctorate in Greek mythology and has like commonly said that the main difference between all like fantasy religions and real world religions is that fantasy religions like have consistency and make sense. Like we have a pantheon of gods, you know, each god has two children and they each have a domain, and like very few of those domains like overlap too heavily. You know, you've got the god of fire, ice, wind and earth. We don't have those, but you know, you've got these themes that are often like really solid and thought out, whereas like in any mythology of the world it's like, oh yeah, Zeus once turned into a swan, and also like
and there's four gods of fire depending on the type.
Yeah, exactly.
Fire.
Like there's like so many gods of warfare, guys. Like and this guy's the god of horses and also the ocean for some reason. Like, and like human mythology, like, or real world mythology is so like filled with that, whereas like that's impossible to remember, and you only remember it because like it's a real world thing in the world, like, or because you're fascinated by it.
but also because you've been told stories of it. Like you get the shorthand for Zeus because you saw Hercules and you see like him grabbing the lightning bolt and throwing it down. Like, now I have a concept. But without a story behind it, it's just a name on a piece of paper. It's a name and a date, like a history textbook.
Yeah, I think if you came to me with the Greek gods as a like fantasy pantheon, and they didn't exist in the world, like they'd be inconsistent and hard to remember. Like it would be a
why is
know,
this guy a swan again?
Just, yeah, like, you keep going back to that. Also,
why is everyone killing
gods,
their kids?
But not gods?
What's going on?
It feels like it would be cleaner if they were all gods. Like, the Titans don't really seem to serve much of an extra purpose in this.
Yeah, we already have demigods. Why is there a super god? What's going on?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the main differences, is being really aware of how you're presenting and the fact that the person reading it is coming at it from the first time.
You've lost the on-ramp of the IP, yeah.
Talking just a little bit more about Doomsong and the original stuff that you guys are making, I think we talked a little bit about how it can be difficult. You have to create that on-ramp that isn't already there. I'm curious, in what ways is original IP easier than working with licensed IP?
Oh, well, one of them is the freedom, is sure. the ability to decide things for the game. Rather than try and wrangle stuff to fit.
Right, you're working in one direction rather than the other.
Yeah, so a really common thing with like wargame IPs, or trying to fit IPs into wargames, a really common like problem with that is that lots and lots of stories are about good versus evil, or, you know, this faction versus this faction. You know, you've got the Empire versus the Rebellion. You've got the Terminators versus the Resistance. You've got the Capital versus the Resistance. There's a lot of Resistances and Rebellions, is what I'm saying. And so, like, and actually for a war game, you want, like, six factions. Like, you want a load of different factions, all with their colorful styles and all being quite different from each other as much as possible. And in hopefully, like, with different melee focuses and ranged focuses and this, that, and the other. So, when, and the same is true of like of RPG stuff as well. When you're creating a world, you can go, oh, there should really be a place for like dungeoneering-y adventures to happen. There should be, you know, an ancient forest filled with mystical stuff that's out there to eat you. There should be big monsters that come into the world and, you know, terrorize settlements. There should be something that's small and dangerous. There should be something that's medium and dangerous, and there should be something massive and dangerous. And you can sort of build that because those are fun things to like encounter and fight or work around, or, you know, work into an adventure. Whereas if you were doing something else, then you're stuck with what you've got. And you might already have those elements, but you're going to be sort of trying to make them fit.
Kind of imagining it as the difference between like drawing an original thing and just doing a really interesting paint, and not paint by numbers, but like there's a difference between drawing and coloring, or like doing like the lines have already been prescribed for you in some ways in the licensed product. Like, yes, you can do a lot of interesting stuff and like make it your own, but ultimately there are some hard edges to it. Whereas an original thing, you know, the edges don't exist until you make them.
And I think it is definitely like important to make those edges and to
sure
to work out where things are and how it all fits together. And but you can create a world to tell literally the story that you're trying to tell. Whereas in an IP focused work, you're doing it completely the other way around. You're trying to find the story in that IP that can be told, which is often a super cool thing because IPs are, or, you know, story-based IPs and things are based to make, to have worlds that are filled with interesting stuff and exciting adventures and things. I think the ones that kind of, the relationships with licenses that have kind of worked best, there's like three different relationships, right? There's the completely like hands-off of, and sometimes that's kind of trust, sometimes it's like, we're making our money and we don't really care a huge amount about like the veracity of this world and stuff. But those ones are fine because, you know, you feel like you can do what you want. And as long as you don't say something ridiculous, then, you know, you're good to go. Then there's the way other end of, no, it's really important that the exact truth of the world rather than its spirit is followed. And, you know, often that's throwing up a lot of problems, especially because a lot of roleplay is about making stuff up in that world and giving players tools to create little bits and change stuff and fill things out. And then there's that middle thing of like the supportive. And often this takes the case of like, oh, we're going to give you a place in the world to make a playground. So in My Little Pony, there was the Badlands, which was a place on the map, on the official map, that they'd never been to in the show. And sure, there could be something there. Go for it. Make an Underdark. And so, yeah, we basically, you know, had this little playground to sort of start off in and sort of do whatever we liked in. And, like, that's really helpful. That freedom of, like, ability to change and make stuff fit the adventure rather than having to follow a in story stuff where you can't change anything about the world, but nothing that's off the beaten path hasn't been fleshed out. For example, if what often gets suggested is, have you ever played The Third Age? It's a Lord of the Rings, like Final Fantasy-esque JRPG sort of game, where you play as essentially a dwarf, a human, and an elf who are kind of following Fellowship of the Ring. And like, so everything that's kind of mentioned in the story, they then fight basically like 10 minutes afterwards. Like, they fight the Balrog for a bit after Gandalf's like been casted, like between, yeah, that I think you fight Sauron. it's not a great game, but it's clearly born of that, like, we can't change the story, but there could have been these three people who had no effect on anything in the world. Like, they just sort of like followed around and had this adventure that didn't really affect anything. And yeah, it's this fundamental misunderstanding of what role plays are and what they're about. And also, like, why people are drawn to IP based role plays is because they love those worlds and want to play in them. And like saying, well, no, you can't. You can't play in them. It's mine. And you can't change anything because it's my special place. Is like, it feels like it has that tone to it. And it is just protecting your brand. And it is trying to like make sure that, you know, you're not diluting the world and making it filled with things that are silly and all that stuff. But it does sometimes feel that you're pushing up against that. And whereas when you're working on your own stuff, you get to hopefully one day be that person to someone else. Be like, no. Do what I said it in my world.
Take it seriously.
Yeah, take it seriously. Yes, we did spell witch strangely. We will pronounce it witch.
There's actually the next thing I want to talk about was you guys are prepping a Kickstarter campaign for an expansion for Doomsong. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you guys are planning for that campaign?
Yeah, so a year and a bit ago now, we did Lord Have Mercy Upon Us, which is essentially the first Horseman of the Apocalypse. Pestilence has entered Paynim and ripped a chunk of it, and sort of it's a sandbox adventure set in this massive world, sort of 350-page hardback that's filled with beautiful, wonderful stuff. And we are building up to the sequel, which is the second Horseman of the Apocalypse. Famine is basically threatening to enter the world. And you explore this region, Cocytus, that is basically on the brink of famine. And everything is getting worse, and everything is slowly becoming more tense, and villages are looking to raid each other, and everyone's desperate. And essentially, you are playing as Witchfinders who work for the Witchfinders Guild, and it has been decided that obviously this famine is witches' fault, and you are to go out there, find the witches, set them alight, and fix all of the problems, and that will definitely solve everything, and we'll stop the apocalypse, and it'll be fine. Spoiler alert, it won't. The apocalypse is coming. This world is doomed. our main goal with this book series is to systematically dismantle this world. So the last book is literally everything has been destroyed. It's not a world in which that's going well. It is the apocalypse. And so, yeah, you play as Witchfinders. It's got a bit more of a sort of investigative focus than Lord Have Mercy Upon Us, which is more sandbox and sort of adventure-y. And yeah, you solve mysteries and sort of make that kind of grim, dark, horrible moral decisions, morally grey world, and try and survive heresy at the same time.
Sounds pretty rad. So Jack, when can people roughly expect this to hit Kickstarter?
So we will be hitting Kickstarter later this year. At the moment, we're toying up between sort of September-ish, but we're not completely nailed down to that at the moment. The best way to find out would be to go to search Doomsong 2 or Thou Shalt Not Suffer the Witch and find us on Kickstarter, click follow, and you should be able to keep up with everything.
Hell yeah. We'll put links to that in the show notes below if you're interested in checking it out.
So Jack, our final question that we like to ask everybody who comes on Talk of the Table is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation for our listeners. This can be anything. It could be in tabletop, outside tabletop, just something you want to share with our audience today.
So I've been trying to play basically a different game every month, bring a new game, get to the table, play, at least one session, usually a few. And so last night I played a bit of Salvage Union, which is mechs and playing as mech pilots and salvaging stuff. And that was a lot of fun. A lot of messed about destroying stuff. I think that, yeah, mech stuff is it's just so evocative and exciting, and does a lot of that because it's its own IP world. A lot of what we talked about of using the hooks of mechs, we all know a lot of the tropes, and it sort of uses a lot of that in a really, really fun way.
Jack, thanks so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online and find your games online if they're looking for them?
So we have a website. That's probably the best place to find us. That is caesarinc.com. We are also on Blue Sky, as I believe at Caesarinc. We are on Discord. We have a Discord that you can join if you want to have a more intimate chat with folks. Probably shouldn't have said the word intimate. It's a normal chat. It's a normal Discord for normal people just talking about Doomsong and other stuff. We are on Instagram and Facebook and all the usual stuff that I'm sure will be in links somewhere.
And if you want more gamey content from us, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter or become a member of our Discord, the Many-Sided Media Discord. Both of those are linked in the show notes below. And if you'd like to support this show, you can also become a member of the Many Sided Media Patreon. You'll get bonus actual plays, cast talkbacks for My First Dungeon, and also roundtable episodes for Talk of the Table, as well as ad-free episodes for both shows and a whole bunch of other goodies thrown in throughout. There's a lot of stuff on our Patreon. It's a really good deal. Go check it out. As always, rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.